Welcome to Prolet Cult, the Antifada side project about the paranormal, the parapolitical, science fiction, and science futurism. About 8 years ago, a popular meme on the left, inspired by Aaron Bastani of Novara Media, was fully automated luxury space communism. Its memes depicted neo-cosmonauts planting red flags on soon-to-be-established lunar communes. But 8 years later, that meme is now decisively cringe, with most of the leftist optimism about the new space age crashed and burned like one of Elon Musk's Starship test flights. But that's not to say that the neoliberal space age of Musk and Bezos is not blasting off. Joining us today is Becca Valentine, the SF-based co-founder of the queer and narco-feminist hackerspace Curious Labs, and the author of a new essay in Strange Matters called Capitalism Storms the Heavens, in which she writes, "We socialists can prepare for the reality of space, or we can plug our ears and pretend like it'll never happen and be completely unprepared for it when it does." Also joining us is longtime friend of the show, Nick Chavez, a writer on the subjects of engineering and communism for Brooklyn Rail, EndNotes, and his Design for Manufacture blog. Thanks for joining us, Becca and Nick. Let me start off by asking both of you what your interest is in space technology and what hopes or fears you have about this not-too-distant future of the new space age and its industries. Let's start with Becca.
I've been interested in space stuff for a very long time. I think I have like a sort of general, you know, nerd's interest in space, right? Space is cool. And the idea of going to space is cool. And the history of going to space is cool. And the possibilities that never happened are sort of like, oh, it's such a sad thing that we never achieved those things. But my interest for the future is more about like, you know, what is plausibly going to happen and how are we going to achieve these things? And who's going to be doing it? Because that kind of matters. Like thinking about the coulda, woulda, shouldas of the past is all good and well. But like, you don't have to confront the realities because it's all done, right? Whereas the near future is kind of, you know, that's upon us and that's stuff that we can impact. And so that's the place where I am like most interested. And as for like my hopes and concerns, my hopes, I guess, are that we actually do achieve some stuff that's more meaningful than just billionaire hotels in space. That would kind of suck. It would be really nice if, especially if leftists could do something more than complain that space is happening without anyone having a say, really. My concern is that capitalists are just going to keep doing what they're doing and leftists are not going to pay any attention at all. Mm-hmm. And the capitalists are just going to have free hands. That's my big concern. That's my real serious concern.
So just a quick follow-up. Would you say that your interest is more because you see this happening and you know it's going to happen and you think leftists need to have a prepare for that? Or do you also think space is cool?
I mean, space is cool. Space is cool. I like, you know, it's cool. But like, you can enjoy the coolness of space without having to like care too much about getting involved.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And, we can look at it. We don't have to go fuck with it.
Yeah. I mean, even if you have the, like the kind of Soviet leftist vision of like going out and colonizing space and sending things to Mars and eventually sending people to God only knows where and whatever, like, you know, that doesn't, like, you can admire that from a distance without like joining the space program or whatever, but like the thinking it's cool is like, you know, whatever, that doesn't imply that one should do anything related to it. But as a leftist, like, the concern that I have is that no one on the left is going to be interested in doing anything except complaining on Twitter about like Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. and I think people should actually do more stuff because of the actual on the ground considerations of these things. You really do need to get involved. Like even if you don't think that space is the future, I think that you do need to get involved somehow.
And we'll be sort of working our way there towards the end of the episode about like what organizing around the new space age might look like. But let's go to Nick. What's your interest in this topic?
So I don't have a big personal connection to it. I mean, like many people, I also think outer space is cool. It's very captivating of the imagination. Like many people, I enjoyer of science fiction. If insofar as I maybe do have any kind of personal connection to space industries or anything like that, I'm a mechanical engineer. I work with manufacturing systems and stuff like that every day. Which is, I'm assuming why you have me here helping co-host this episode. Technical considerations, the way that these manifest in different kind of industries, these are all things that I like to keep a close eye on. Although I don't pay as close attention to space stuff as I do other industries. But I am very much in agreement with Becca about the fact that it's not good, this general state of whether you want to call it like the left or socialists or whatever, that like don't have a lot of kind of there aren't a lot of people with technical backgrounds, technical training represented among the left, however you want to describe it today. And so insofar as people want to actually be able to have any kind of say in whether it be space or any other kind of industry that has a technical significant technical component to it, which is most industries of any kind, there needs to be an effort to either gain that knowledge or incorporate people who have that kind of knowledge.
All right. So let's start off by talking a little bit about what this new space age looks like, maybe the visions of some of its key players. And especially with the recent election results, it appears that space exploration is going to be dominated, at least from the U.S. standpoint, by, I guess you could say, two main players, the private sector and what's left of the public sector, which is going to increasingly move towards a public-private military coalition between NASA, Space Force, and the private sector. And the two dominant figures in the private sector are Musk and Bezos, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, of course, Robert Bigelow. And there's a big number of smaller groups making a play for these contracts. But Musk and Bezos are definitely the big ones, and they're really competitive with one another. I think they like personally do not like each other. So I want to ask Becca, let's look at Musk and Bezos first. Like, what is Musk's vision? What does he want? And Bezos as well, because you talk about both of them in your essay.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people have heard Musk's vision to some degree. Musk wants to make humanity a multiplanetary species and put people on Mars and whatever that fantasy is. This goes all the way back to, I guess, like 2002 or so for him, just after PayPal was acquired by eBay and he got really rich. Like the first thing he did was try to buy a flight to Mars on like a Russian rocket, and he wanted to put like a greenhouse on Mars with a camera, with the hope of like inspiring people to like support going to Mars and stuff like this. And,
oh my God, I never heard that story. That's crazy.
Oh yeah, he was in Russia and was like about to like buy a rocket, and like it fell through like on the flight back or something like this. But he eventually realized that like people actually like the idea of going to space. It's not the motivation that's the problem. It's that people don't seem to think that it's feasible. And so that's why he founded SpaceX, because he decided that, well, if people don't think it's feasible, we have to make it obviously feasible by just doing all the things ourselves, because, convincing the public is not going to work. You convince through showing it can be done, not by like arguing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he's been doing. And that is the main driver of all the decisions that he's made in the direction of that company. And you know, like,
and you think that's sincere? Because I always sort of read it as like the Mars thing is bullshit. Because I've just read so many things that just makes the colonization of Mars just seem totally implausible. But then,
I mean,
as he gets there, he's doing all this real stuff, like the
I have no idea how sincere he actually is, but I mean, he's a nerd who wants to be Captain Kirk. Like, I can totally believe that, you know, this sort of person, you give him like a few billion dollars and he's like, yeah, I'm going to try to go to Mars. Like, why not? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, if that's the sort of person you are, you can be sincere and wrong about the feasibility of something.
Sure. He's also extremely narcissistic and delusional. So,
oh yeah, absolutely. So yeah, his vision is to colonize Mars, which, you know, has motivated a lot of the specific design choices, right? Like the fact that all of these rockets that he's building can now land is motivated entirely by the fact that, like, you can't really put a large object on Mars without having some sort of like rocket descent mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Curiosity was the first rover that we put on Mars with rocket descent, and that was, we needed to do rocket descent for that because it was big enough that it would just crash into Mars if you didn't have one. You know, you can't use parachutes or anything at that scale. So Musk's vision is Mars. Like, that's where he's headed.
Mm-hmm.
Bezos's vision, less well known, I think. But in my opinion, like, somewhat more reasonable as a goal, right? So Bezos's long-term vision is that we should basically colonize the asteroid belt, move all industrial activity off of Earth and into space so that Earth can just be this beautiful verdant garden, right? Like, that's his stated plan, his stated goal, right? How real that is also, I don't know. Who knows, right? But he's also dumping huge amounts of money into basically the same problem of, like, launching enormous things into space in ways that don't just dump the rocket into the ocean. So those are their official plans.
And
one
of
them sounds a bit more far-fetched.
You said, but Bezos actually wants to build these colonies in asteroid belts, right? And I know that he's specifically interested in these Murphy colonies that I saw one Blue Origin press conference a few years ago where he made it look exactly like the one from Elysium, which was not a movie about how cool Murphy colonies are, but these divisions are like a self-sustaining city-state in space, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Like a biodome in space. And the article, you say that in many ways it's a plausible vision.
Long-term, maybe. All right, maybe. You know, we haven't yet figured out on Earth how to make something self-sustainable and sealed. But, you know, the Earth itself is self-sustainable and sealed. Like, we're not, you know, there is no biodiversity in space, right? It's all here on Earth. We're not, mm-hmm. we're not like reliant on anything but light from the sun, right? Like, we're not getting clean water from anywhere other than Earth, right? That's the only place. So obviously there's at least one scale at which a closed environment can more or less function sustainably. The question is, can we scale it down? We haven't succeeded in doing that. Who knows when we will, right? Though I do think that it's implausible to sort of imagine that you will have truly self-sustaining colonies, right? I mean, no place on Earth is self-sustaining, right? Everything is part of a larger context except the planet as a whole,
mm-hmm.
right? And the moment we start building permanent stuff in space, it will still interact with Earth, like it will have to. And it's extremely implausible that even over the long term, we will stop making like routine runs to Earth for this or that or whatever. It's going to be one big economy in the solar system, right? I don't think that this idea of like isolated little self-sustained things is feasible. And, you know, the various things that were like, oh, well, maybe you'll get like mold growth or whatever that takes over your space station or something like this. Yeah, that might happen, right? I don't know. How you deal with that is a separate issue from how you...
Oh, Clorox bleach.
We're not going to make biodome, right? We're not making biodome. We're not worried about outside food coming in. Mm-hmm. Of course, that will happen.
All right. I'll just add what little I know about Space Force, and of course NASA is also a U.S. state project, but it seems like for sure now in the Trump administration, NASA is going to be, it's already been privatized over the last several decades, and it'll probably be slashed like even farther. So Space Force, I think, is going to become the major state player in space, and despite their branding as like a cool Star Trek looking thing, what they really do is they're not interested in sending soldiers to space, at least not just yet. They're into protecting and developing the military capacity of the telecommunications satellites. I mean, especially GPS is like was originally, I think, a Navy project. The U.S. state developed and launched it into space. There's an increasing number of similar things like Starlink and Blue Origin has its own version of this. So, and these also have very important ramifications for military communications, you know, and it's played out in the war in Ukraine, where Starlink was initially gifted to the Ukrainian forces and then taken away when they failed to make a payment. So the question of like how resilient these networks are in war and in international conflict has become really an important military question. And so the U.S. wants to keep an edge in that. China is also attempting to get an edge in that, as is India. These are the two really emergent space programs. And then Musk is sort of this interesting character because he's leaped way far out ahead, like, you know, thanks a lot to a lot of privatization from NASA. And now he's neither a U.S. state agent. He has no major allegiance to the United States, but he's someone who is kind of like too big to fail. SpaceX is kind of too big to fail in terms of the interests of the U.S. state and of Space Force. Do you get a sense that that's basically the idea of what Space Force does, Becca?
Yeah, my understanding of Space Force is that it's more or less just like focused on monitoring the new developments in space and new potential threats in space and sort of trying to cajole people into doing things that help make the U.S. more secure on that front. I'm not sure if they even have any rockets. They might actually like launch some things. I don't know. But I don't think that they have a significant like presence in actually putting stuff in space and developing technology to put stuff in space.
I think this is part of the reason that Trump wanted to annex Greenland. Do you remember that? When he wanted to buy Greenland from Denmark?
That sounds like a terrible idea. I'm not really sure why you'd want to do that. That sounds so stupid. I mean, it sounds like something Trump would do. Like, I get polar orbits, I guess. But why would you build a launch pad for polar orbits in Greenland?
Well, you know, I haven't read about this in a while. Maybe it wasn't a launch pad, but they wanted Greenland for Space Force specifically. I mean, I guess there's other military uses of Greenland as well. But anyway, let's move forward to what your article is mostly about is what's going to drive development in space is the plausibility of these industries, these orbital industries, and what makes them more plausible now than ever. And you do a really good job explaining this, is that although people on the left like to imagine that Musk is a big failure and all of his rockets crash and burn, in reality, you write, so SpaceX's first successful launch of a rocket that put a satellite into low Earth orbit, but then landed safely on a barge instead of disintegrating and crashing. Since 2016, SpaceX's Falcon 9 has reached a total of 252 reflights of previously launched rockets, with some vehicles being used up to 20 times. That lets SpaceX pocket basically all of the launch costs because SpaceX hasn't changed launch pricing at all relative to when they weren't reusing the rockets, and then dumped the profits into the development of their Starship launcher. You go on to say, when launch to low Earth orbit becomes 100 times cheaper, we can expect corporations to increase their orbital presence dramatically. Plus, Starship can readily be used as a space station and so can quickly expand research lab capacity in orbit. So you see this new space age coming pretty rapidly to the point where SpaceX will have new space stations in space and will be traveling to and from space rapidly enough that these industries can be developed. So what are some of the industries that, besides Starlink, that we could be seeing in the near future?
Yeah, so my understanding of the current research into using space for like stuff other than just, you know, communications, is low gravity environments are supposedly useful for developing various kinds of drugs, for manufacturing certain kinds of drugs. There is some reason to think that semiconductor manufacturing has interesting properties in space. Those are the sort of slightly more long-term stuff, because you need to do research in zero gravity to actually like know what is viable and know how to make those things viable. There are some more near-term things that are kind of, you might say, almost navel-gazing, because it's like, well, you know, we only need this to support the other stuff that that is in space, right? But so like on-orbit refueling, you know, you put a satellite up into space, and if it only lasts you 5 years or whatever, because it's in such a low orbit that it's slowing down every time it makes a close pass to Earth or whatever. Well, okay, so now you have to be willing to like let that satellite deorbit and burn up, right? Well, okay, maybe you put some fuel in it so you can boost it back up to the appropriate orbit periodically. But you have a finite fuel tank, right? Like, you don't have an infinitely large fuel tank. And there are no gas stations in space. But if there were, you could keep your satellites up there for a lot longer, right? And it's a heck of a lot cheaper to put fuel into space than to build a whole new satellite. And this is a thing that's really being developed right now, right? So this is kind of the navel-gazing version of industry in space, where it exists only to support other stuff that isn't really like, oh, we need space to develop this cool new technology. It's just, well, we need these satellites to be up there, right? But we want those satellites to be up there longer, right? So if you could get those to stay up there without having to deorbit, cool. And so that's one of the things that's being developed right now by at least two companies. And one of them, so I think there's like a Lockheed project, and then there's a, was it Orbit Fab or something like this? I forget, I'd have to go look it up. But one of them is like a cooperative project with the government, right? Like, it's co-developed by maybe some people at JPL and Orbit Fab or something like this. I forget exactly which. And so there are like at least two standards that exist for fueling ports now that are getting like installed on satellites that are going to be launched with the intention of being like, you know, filling up the gas tank on the satellite while it's in orbit. And that is a far more tangible and short-term thing that will make people a bunch of money and is sort of an in-space industry, but isn't what usually people think of.
Yeah, I guess moving towards what people do normally think of, you know, in Aaron Bastani's book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, there's a chapter on space. And he, among the things he predicted was that asteroid mining could, for example, end all mining on Earth, which is a really horrible, extractive, brutal, ecocidal industry. And so he thought that, you know, just developing this industry would be enormously beneficial to life on Earth. And you make a similar optimistic prediction about mining energy, you know, orbiting solar power in space. You write, solar panels in space are vastly more productive than ones on the ground, producing upwards of 8 times more energy output. It can be in full sunlight almost constantly and without interference from the atmosphere. It can take in approximately 1,300 watts of light per square meter compared to 1,000 on the ground. And you write something similar about getting water from asteroids, which of course will be important if we do have off-Earth colonies. You write, the solar system is chock full of small asteroids with large quantities of water ice and hydrocarbon ice. For instance, frozen methane. Water can be electrolyzed into oxygen and hydrogen, which can be burned, or the oxygen can be used as an oxidizer for hydrocarbon fuels, capturing such such water or hydrocarbon-rich asteroids, and extracting the frozen material is beyond our current abilities, but that's almost entirely due to the cost of launching vehicles into space. So on both fronts, but mainly on the question of energy, so if there were, for example, thousands of solar panel satellites in space, how would that energy get back to Earth?
So the standard answer that you'll find, and which is probably the one that's going to actually happen because we know how to kind of do it, is with microwaves. As far back as the late 80s, I think, we've been testing large-scale power transmission using microwave rectennas. Rectennas are rectifying antenna. It's not like a deeply interesting technology. It's just an antenna with a rectifier. And you can make very simple ones literally with just like two pieces of wire and a diode. There were some tests that I think JPL did at the Goldstone Range back in the late 80s that transmitted like 20 kilowatts or so over 10 kilometers, which is like a lot, right? Like that's a lot of power. That's like a whole house's worth of power transmitted wirelessly with microwaves over multiple kilometers. So we've known how to do this since the 80s, right? It's possible. It's like 90% efficient or something. It's like it's feasible. The most likely difficulty that's going to arise is like your satellites are really far away, so you need to keep this thing like pointed in the right place. You don't want to like fry a city. It's not good. if you're beaming a gigawatt of microwaves down to Earth, you know, 1 degree off from 80,000 kilometers up is a lot, right? It's not a small amount. That's quite a bit. The current proposals are to use phased array antennas, right? So if you use a phased array, you can very, very quickly adjust where it's pointing. And this is already being developed. These things are being built and developed for all sorts of reasons. And the idea of using a large phased array for power transmission is really not a stretch, right? It's just a different application of a technology that is extremely well understood for other purposes, right? Like phased array radar is quite common. It's a really good way to like sweep a beam of a radar beam across the sky really quickly instead of having like a dish that turns, right? And so these things are not novel technologies. And so probably it's going to be a phased array microwave rectenna system. That's how we're going to do it.
Really stupid question, but is this how wireless charging works on a cell phone?
No. Okay. wireless charging on a cell phone is actually more like a, you know, like the power bricks that you plug into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Those have two coils in them, right? It's a transformer. It has two coils in them, and one side has one particular number of windings, and the other side has a different number of windings, and you know, it turns electricity into a magnetic field in one coil, and then the other coil takes that magnetic field and turns it back into electricity, usually at a different voltage and amperage. The ones in your phone are more like that, right? There's like a coil in your phone and there's a coil in the charging pad. And when you put them next to each other, the one charges the other, right? Okay. And it's basically the same thing that existed in like the cordless electric toothbrushes for ages, right? It's just a slightly fancier version.
Mm. All right. Let's throw it to Nick. What are your thoughts on the plausibility of some of these industries?
Yeah, there's, I think from a technical standpoint, there's a lot of different types of things that can be done in space that are really fascinating and that could absolutely have a lot of benefits, also a lot of downsides, of course. One thing I'm kind of wondering about is, so manufacturing already like here, planet side, you know, not in space, it's very capital intensive. It takes a lot of money to get a factory up and going, and it takes a long time for the revenue to actually like break even on that. And then even after that, profits tend to be pretty slim. And so, obviously with things like, you know, really novel semiconductor and drug manufacturing, things like that can, probably fetch a pretty high price when it gets brought back down to Earth. But a lot of your piece really focuses on moving, you know, entire industrial processes like, you know, metal smelting and refining and all sorts of other like large scale manufacturing up into space. And I'm kind of wondering how you envision, you know, companies being able to surmount the like really high capital costs and like barriers to productivity in order to make this happen.
Yeah, so I wanna make it very clear that in my article, I do not sort of take the Bastani view of like, oh, we should move all of this stuff into space, right? I don't think that that's going to happen anytime soon. That's much more of a like Bezosian long-term vision of what's going to happen. My perspective on the future is that the stuff that's going to get manufactured in space is almost entirely going to stay in space. Like drugs and semiconductor manufacturing, we might drop some stuff from orbit for that, right? Especially drugs, because drugs, like comparatively lightweight compared to, what is a dose of a drug? A few milligrams or a few grams or whatever, depending on what your drug is. Like a ton returned to Earth is millions of doses. Okay. A ton of semiconductors returned to Earth is like, I don't know, a fair number of 100,000 semiconductors, something. I have no idea. We are not going to mine iron in space and drop that to Earth. That would just be nuts. There's no reason to do that. It's far easier to do that cleanly on Earth than it is to do it in space at all. The stuff that's going to be mined or built in space are things that are going to be needed in space. And so my article focuses very heavily on the way that existing presence in space will benefit from stuff that can be acquired in space, and how the near-term stuff that we'll be building into space, like you know, semiconductor manufacturing or pharmaceutical manufacturing, will motivate more stuff to be built out in space for use in space, right? Like, if we're building semiconductors in space and we need specialists up there to do this, they will need water and air and whatever. And if we can source that from space rather than launching it from Earth, it's a lot cheaper. But I don't think that we're going to be building, you know, your next iPhone or something in space and then dropping that to Earth.
I agree. It would be kind of, it'd be nonsense to, you know, not only do all that in space, but then drop a really hot, heavy object out. It also just sounds kind of dangerous, and like there's a lot of risks involved in dropping a big steel structure down and hoping for the best.
Yeah, like even with SpaceX landing things, you still, like, why would you do that? Like, why would you build something up there and then use a very expensive launch vehicle to return it to Earth when you could just not? This is also, I think, like one of the big problems of Elon Musk's vision of going to Mars, right? Is like the whole, why would you go to Mars when you could just stop before you get to Mars and do anything else?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe this is a good time to move to some of the more political questions of the essay, and going back to Bastani's book, a lot of that optimism that he talked about was, you know, he was writing it, I believe it was published in 2018 or 2019. And at the time he wrote it, he thought that Sanders was going to win in the United States and Corbyn was going to win in the UK, and that the pink tide would continue throughout Latin America. And we would see in the 2020s, this decade that we're now halfway through, a social democratic restructuring worldwide. Of course, we're mostly seeing the opposite, something more like a far-right anarcho-capitalist restructuring in which Musk and Bezos are playing a major role, and Trump's appointees and NASA and Space Force will as well. Maybe China has different visions of their space industries, but I don't really know much about that. But for example, when we're talking about Musk, he's building a star factory. It's a SpaceX factory in Boca Chica that plans to eventually produce 1,000 upper stage Starship rockets annually. And he recently released some footage of robots welding Starship's nose cone together. You always have to wonder with Musk how real this stuff is, but SpaceX does seem to be one of his more legitimate brands. I mean, Tesla's cars actually drive, of course, that's real stuff, but SpaceX has done some things that the United States has not been able to do in the space industry in a long time. So this Star Factory really might be at the kind of industrial vanguard of this new space age. And so the last part of your essay asks, how would we organize something like Star Factory? And then if Star Factory leads to more off-Earth life, how would we organize those off-Earth production factories, those research stations, those factories in space, or those Murphy colonies? You write, it's important to understand that every job in the space industry requires a decent amount of education, usually that's science and engineering, but some of it's technical, such as machinist skills. Where labor organizing is concerned, engineers and other white-collar workers in the space industry are effectively out of reach currently and will likely remain so for the foreseeable future. So are there other points in the assembly line that could be organized, like the factories that make these starships? Could they be reached by the components of making the starships or even the robots? Is it possible to organize downstream from the more technical side of things?
Yeah, so like modulo automation, you have people, right? There are people welding things, there are people running the machine shops. They potentially could be organized. Like machinists are a classic example of a group of people who have been organized in the past, right? Welders unions exist, machinist unions exist. Less so today for machinists, at least, because we don't do terribly much manufacturing in the United States compared to, you know, 75 years ago, right? But like, these are not industries that have historically been resistant to organizing like engineers have been. Whether or not we actually organize those communities is a separate question, right? Like, it needs to happen. And the more that the left sort of treats the entirety of space as like a joke that, you know, you point at billionaires and you laugh. I mean, it's like, imagine if you did that with like oil rig workers or something, right? Like, great. So like, I don't know the politics of oil rig workers these days, but like, if you did this when oil rigs were just, you know, starting to be a thing, I doubt that you would have any hope of organizing oil rig workers, right? You have to take it seriously if you want to organize it. And that's the important thing. People have to like actually recognize that whether you like what Musk is doing or not, he still hires a whole bunch of people to do these things, right? Like, you don't have to like it. I mean, we live under capitalism. We don't like it, period, right? Like, part of the point of organizing is you don't like the stuff that's happening, but it's still happening and you have to organize people. I don't know. Like, yes, these are people you can organize, right?
When you mentioned the oil rig workers, you use that as an example of your article of like what it might be like to organize people who are working in space, because you can't just stand outside the factory gates with a newspaper or something and organize them because they're very remote. But this is sort of a different question than organizing like the engineers at SpaceX. What are your thoughts on this, Nick, as an engineer yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty undeniable that there's a certain class position that engineers on average occupy. I don't just mean like as in terms of like, you know, their individual incomes or whatever, but like the role of engineering historically has always been to utilize technology to command the labor of people who are paid less, and then in turn, you know, further reinforces the fact that you can continue to pay them less. That's kind of the content of that. And so it's an ongoing challenge to figure out what it means to integrate people with engineering expertise into socialist politics. It's a open question mark. I would think that early, you know, assuming that this kind of space industry takes off to the point where there's actually a lot of people, like, you know, an appreciable number of people up there, more than just like, you know, five people at a time, the first people up there are going to be, I would assume, people who have like combined and like really high tech engineering backgrounds, as well as the kind of manual skills. If you look at, you know, astronauts who are currently up there, they're all like, they all have these insanely stacked resumes, and they all have a lot of competencies that span what, you know, on the surface we may consider to be on both sides of the mental manual divide. And so I think maybe, you know, looking at this in terms of like organizing engineers versus non-engineers, maybe may not quite apply in this kind of situation, given that a lot of the early people who go up may in fact be people who kind of straddle both sides of that. But also, I think we have to keep in mind here that like these industries are highly integrated into the military. And so there's going to be a lot of like, there's the people who are going to be first getting sent up there and who are going to be forming this kind of initial wave of, you know, space workers, assuming that this kind of thing really takes off and there, it does become like a big manufacturing sector up there. It's going to be very deeply tied into the military. It's not going to be a purely private affair. And so that also has to be very strongly considered by anybody who wants to do any kind of labor organizing in that sphere.
So Nick, you wrote actually on this subject before. I didn't realize this before I asked you to come on, but you wrote about something pretty similar in your review for Emmy O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi's Everything for Everyone, which is a sci-fi novel written as an oral history that takes place in the aftermath of a communization-style communist revolution. Have you read this, Becca?
I've read the review, but I haven't okay. I haven't read the actual oral history.
All right.
I love this review. Thank you for writing this, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
So I'll just sum up this part of the book, because this was sort of the part of the book you were the most critical of, or at least you use that as an example of what you're critical of about the book. It depicts the takeover of operations at a company called EXT, which is a private space company supporting extraterrestrial communities of the ultra wealthy. This company, once a large transnational firm, centralized its entire operation to a headquarters in Long Island and a manufacturing site in Pennsylvania before the onset of the revolution. This manufacturing was all done by bot or by 3D printer, which was mostly operated remotely from Long Island. You write that when the headquarters was seized, the revolutionaries sent messages to the workers there in Pennsylvania that it was time to go. I wasn't really sure what time to go meant. Before dispatching.
That makes two of us. And yeah. Audience can't see it, but that's a quote from the book. That was actually a line from that one of the characters said.
Does it mean like time to go as in like time to be a revolutionary?
Time to leave the factory.
Yeah, and then it's before dispatching some people to mop up. So maybe just like they replaced the EXT people with like communist engineers, possibly. HQ itself was seized by a coalition of revolutionary militias after several years of infiltration and planning by scientists and engineers passionate about space exploration, end quote. So what do you think this account gets particularly wrong?
Yeah, so we don't have to spend too much time on this because it is a pretty scathing review, and I think that, you know, I don't want to beat on them too much harder than I did in this review.
You have some positive things to say in the review as well.
Yeah, I think there are things I like about this book, even if overall I don't have a particularly sympathetic account of it. But yeah, I mean, the core kind of issue with this book as a whole, but, you know, that's really evidenced in this particular chapter, is that there's this kind of treatment of manufacturing and just kind of technical sciences as something that, the actual manufacturing and like the, you know, people who have to actually do this work to make a living and also like make all this kind of flashy space stuff possible. The book treats it like quite literally as something that happens over there out of sight. It's like, and then something that can be just like fully automated by quote bot or 3D printer, which I'll talk about in a sec, the kind of some silliness about what that implies. And then the fact that it's just that they, you know, they automate it and then just HQ can push a bunch of buttons, which makes like the stuff over there that you don't need to think about, like do whatever you want. It's very like on the nose for how I think a lot of people in the left understand manufacturing and production generally, even though the fact that like our entire modern world is like so like inextricably dependent on these like massive global systems of production and material flow. And this book just kind of had a really good opportunity to explore that, but didn't. This idea that you can just like take a factory full of people manufacturing a bunch of really complicated stuff. And let's be clear, like space equipment is complicated to manufacture. It's complicated in every single way you can imagine. It's really technically complex. You know, the idea that you can just replace all the people making this stuff with a bunch of robots and 3D printers, there's like one, it's just, you know, it's just kind of like obviously not true. But secondly, like, let's say that, you know, it's a science fiction book. Let's say that they have these like really miraculous robots and 3D printers that can, in fact, like totally fully automate a production facility of that kind. And you don't need like a super massive complicated supply chain. Again, another piece of like kind of fantasy in order to make this happen. Like, why were these revolutionaries using the 3D printers just for like space stuff? Why didn't they use it for like literally anything else? Like, it's just a real shortcoming of that book, which is a shame, because like I said, there were things I think it did very well. So that obviously is, you know, different than what Becker wrote, like similar topics superficially, but obviously different level of paying attention to stuff going on here.
Yeah. So Becca, you know, without having read the book yourself, what were your thoughts on this sort of scenario as Nick lays it out?
I think Nick's points about, you know, the lack of focus on like actual workers and the fantasy of like, oh, this is going to be the white collar people storming the HQ is exactly right. You know, like this is really missing the point. Like those are not the people that need to be organized. They're going to be office workers and stuff. And if you're focusing on that, like, I don't know what kind of science fiction you're writing, if that's what you're doing, especially socialist science fiction. I'm not really sure I've seen terribly much socialist science fiction that focuses on office workers, especially white collar workers. Like that just seems very not like on brand. I don't know. I've read a lot of more or less socialist sci-fi that does the things that Nick wants, right? Of like thinking, well, okay, what if we do have, if we had these 3D printers that could magically just do all the things, how are the left gonna like make use of this somehow, right? I've read stories about that, and to see that be relevant here but not actually addressed is like, yeah, what, like how are you gonna like completely omit that? Yeah, I found this review quite good, and I think Nick is entirely on point with all of it.
Yeah, it kind of struck me as trying to incorporate some of that space communism stuff into the book without like totally working out the full scope of what it would look like. And Becca, your essay is obviously, you know, more grounded in like the realities of what's happening in this space industry. And one thing you talk about that's maybe a little bit of a parallel is what it would be like if there were labor actions in space amongst the workers, sort of like those oil rig workers. What if someone smuggles pamphlet aboard and they decide to unionize? You write, while getting people to space will be drastically cheaper, it's not as cheap as bussing people over in from one town over. You can't just hire scabs. So the initial space labor situation should at least make it possible for workers to significantly exert their power, at least if they find ways to protect themselves from being thrown out of an airlock. And I think this is part of Musk's fantasy of why he likes the idea of space production so much, or space colonies, is that, well, you send these people up, they're going to be indentured in some way to the company, to their job. And then if they disobey you, you can sort of just remotely kill them. And so that might be enough to make people way too captive to ever rebel in any meaningful way, at least while these industries haven't been set up or still dependent on the operators on Earth.
Yeah, a lot of this depends on how we get to that point, right? Like if we just let the capitalists do whatever they want, the initial set of people that are going to go up there will be pretty safe because, you know, as Nick points out, they're going to be, you know, highly skilled. Like astronauts right now are very, very skilled, right? And you can't just like drop one of them out an airlock. You can't do that. But further down the road, if we as leftists have just let the capitalists run wild with this, and not tried to organize anything before we start putting people on asteroids or whatever to like mine things, that is where like we could be in a dangerous situation, right? Like, it's entirely feasible to imagine a future where you can't just push a button at ground control and vent the atmosphere. But you have to imagine that future before the space station gets designed, right? Because if you do it after it's been designed and after it's been launched, you're fucked. All right, you have to do it now in preparation for that. You need to have like the laws in place to mandate safety procedures and safety mechanisms that are like controllable on site, not remotely. or at least have overrides locally on the state. Like all of these things have to happen long in advance. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is possible to sort of imagine a future where you could have labor actions in space where you don't have these risks of just getting thrown out an airlock by, you know, pressing a button, but you have to think ahead.
So what are some of the proposals that we might look towards now of making this new space age that's being built a little bit more amenable to labor or to socialist organizing?
So in the article, I think I mentioned three major things that people can do. One is sort of the traditional appeal to government kind of thing. Make sure that, you know, protest and get laws passed and whatever to ensure that there's safety stuff in place. OSHA probably has something to say about all of these things. And so, if you're going that route, that would be probably a reasonable thing to try to do. But that is also like not the necessarily the most radical of approaches. also not necessarily a radical approach, but something that the left kind of needs to do more of is actually, you know, get involved. Like Nick is right to say that there aren't terribly many highly technically trained leftists. It's extremely frustrating that like the bulk of engineers are like rather libertarian, right? Or, you know, software engineers, right? I work in the software industry and like there are leftists, right? But like that's not an immensely common thing, right? To have someone who's explicitly anti-capitalist.
Yeah, as we sort of just found out today, we're recording this, by the way, on Monday, December 9th, and we just found the identity of the alleged United Healthcare CEO shooter is a man of STEM and
rancid politics.
As far as his views go, in terms of a critique of capitalism, he seems to be very inspired by the work of a lot of sort of futurists, like libertarian futurists, including Peter Thiel and people like that. A guy who took a radical act, but maybe not from the most radical background.
I'm not a very conspiracy theory minded person. I don't normally say things like this. And this take will almost assuredly age like horrifically. So, you know, audience, if you're listening to this like 3 days, like beware.
Not as horrifically as some of the memes I've seen over the last week about who this guy is, but
yeah. He kind of looks like a friend of mine, so I've been coming.
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.